My name is Tom Witt, and this is a session entitled Living Epistles of Hope on Cesar Chavez. This is part of a series that we hope will last all summer and at least happen on Saturday afternoons at 4 o'clock on Living Epistles of Hope, expanding on our summer theme of living the politics of hope. One of the ideas that we had was, instead of just only looking at the concept of hope, also look at people who live out hope in their lives and have that be a good way to get into our summer theme a little bit more. So we've started some sessions on living epistles of hope. There have been several already. John Schramm has done an hour biography on Dorothy Day, the Catholic worker movement, and David Christian has done an hour session on Domelder Câmara, Archbishop of Recife, Brazil, and both of those tapes are in the tape library. And I will continue today with Cesar Chavez and the United Farm Workers Movement. Has anyone not heard of Cesar Chavez? Has everyone kind of heard the name at all? Okay. Those of you who have heard of Cesar Chavez, would you be willing to share what you've heard about him or a fact or an impression or anything you know at all about the farm workers movement? Just real quickly, we'll take 30 seconds or a minute to see if anyone has any.
I'll give you an opposite. If you're a fruit grower, you don't take too much of it, and you're accused of being all sorts of inhuman because you are a fruit grower hiring.
Okay. Well, that's an impression. Yeah. I think that's probably true for a lot of the growers in California.
However, I will say this, that he started out to have in the minds of people, both in the industry and who live around it, the fruit industry, I'm thinking of the apple industry, I come from the Wenatchee Valley, that here was a man who was going to pull things together, and they had quite a lot of respect for it. But now they suspect, right or wrong, that there's political ambition in him, mm-hmm. and power, even to the detriment of his own people.
Okay.
Now, right or wrong.
Yeah.
I read an article in the Tacoma paper about that, too. And it made me bad feelings. Of course, what you read in paper sometimes is not always true.
Yeah.
That's for sure.
Yeah, we'll get into that a little later about the media and Cesar Chavez and what kinds of impressions you get from the newspapers. I'll just share my only impression is when I was quite a bit younger, I went with my parents to a rally in Chicago of the United Farm Workers Movement and heard Cesar Chavez speak, and our family boycotted grapes for 5 or 6 years, and so I always had a remembrance of who Cesar was, and so I picked him because I had that remembrance. This session is going to be somewhat different because, unlike Domelder Câmara and Dorothy Day, Cesar Chavez has not written anything, so I can't really share with you books or lots of lectures. That's not a big part of his life. Most of what I'll be talking about is the United Farm Workers Movement. That is basically who Cesar Chavez is. I'll share with you two of the sources that I found most important. One I don't have with me. Another one is his autobiography that was actually written by someone else for him, but are his words, by Jacques Levy, the autobiography of Cesar Chavez. Another one that's in the bookstore is called The Struggle for Humanity, Agents of Nonviolent Change in a Violent World. It's an excellent book if you want a brief overview of some epistles of hope, like Domelder Câmara and Lanza de Basto and Cesar Chavez and Kenneth Cuanda of... who's Kenneth Cuanda? President of Zambia. Another book is also in the bookstore, The Power of the People, Active Nonviolence in the United States. This is just a fun book because it has so many great pictures of a history that we are not very well aware of in the United States, which is the history of nonviolence. And in this book, there is a short chapter on Cesar Chavez and United Farm Workers. So much for an introduction. To set the stage for you, I have to give you a little bit of history. And I was not very much aware of California agriculture or how that worked. And I assume that not many of you are either, so I'll give you a little bit of what I know from my reading. And I'm going to be setting up a little bit of a David and Goliath scene, and it's fairly accurate. In Cesar Chavez, we have a man that's totally committed to nonviolence, hoping to battle, on the other hand, an agribusiness industry that has traditionally used all manner of violence to suppress any previous attempts to organize farm workers in California. I have to tell you a little bit about California agriculture. If you're from the Midwest, like I am, you have to sort of change your image of the small family farm in order to talk about California farm workers. I guess I lived with the myth for a long time that in California there are lots of, quote, farmers that should get the same kind of privileges and protection that farmers maybe in Wenatchee or Iowa hog farmers should get. And I don't know if that's particularly true, because in California, I know this is a generalization, but they don't even like the name farmers, but prefer to be called growers or agribusinessmen or ranchers. They are not particularly small town folk, very influential people, the growers are. They control the California courts, lobby for and against legislation, and they dominate the executive branches of the government. But at times, when it serves them, they will appeal to the public as farmers. And so there is some confusion about, or some assumptions about farmers in California that we're not always aware of. Farming in California is not mostly small family farms, although there are some. Agriculture is the largest industry in California, and something that I wasn't aware of is California ranks number one in the nation in agriculture. In 1967, I'm sorry, it seems like an ancient figure, but in 67 they had a $4.6 billion year. And I don't know what it would be now, but I'm sure it's much, much more, because in California, agricultural acreage is actually increasing, whereas in most of the rest of the country, acreage for agriculture is decreasing. But as farms are becoming, as there is more agricultural land, farms really are becoming fewer and fewer and bigger, because most of the land is owned by large conglomerates and corporations. The average 700 acres is the average size of a farm in California, which is about twice the national average. And I think 7% of the state's farms occupy 80% of the arable land. That gives you a little idea of what kind of control corporations have over farmland in California. The farms are heavily irrigated in the California grapevine, which make them very productive, but also make them very, very expensive. And the land values are tremendously high. So you can't just be anybody and own land, farmland in the grapevine.
Say that again, 7% own 80%?
7% of the state's farms, and those are those that are over 1,000 acres, occupy 80% of the land, arable land. And I can make an analogy here to between California and some third world situations where land is available and the workers are plentiful. I think it's a little bit different from Midwest farming, because I think Midwest farming is a little bit more capital intensive, whereas the kind of crops that are grown in California are still labor intensive, take a lot of workers. So similar to third world countries, where you have to have this constant supply of cheap labor, it's much the same in California, where in order to maintain that kind of style of farming and the lifestyle of the growers, you have to have a constant flow of new immigrant cheap labor. And so I'll make some connections between California agriculture and the third world, but I don't want to carry that too far. On the other side, the David side of the David and Goliath picture, for most of us, probably our only exposure to the life of the migrant farm worker comes from the movie Grapes of Wrath with Henry Fonda. Has anyone seen that? on TV or in the theaters. It's a good movie, but it's a shame that it was made so long ago, because some people think that those kind of conditions stopped after the Depression ended, and that's really not true. In some places, they're much, much better. For instance, in the Washington area, they're much, much better than in lots of places in California. But farm workers have been for a long time and still are the lowest paid income group in the country. And just like in that movie, every year growers are still dependent upon that continual supply of seasonal workers. And it hasn't always been Mexicans. One minority after another has been imported into the farm labor force and exploited. In California, it was the Chinese that were followed by the Japanese and the Filipinos, and now the Mexicans. Today, there are a few Arabs, Pakistanis, Portuguese, American blacks, and some, quote, Okies, as they were called in the movie. They make up the fringes of that workforce. But for the most part, in the 20th century, it has been the Mexicans that have been the largest group that has been exploited. At the turn of the century, there were about 8,000 Mexican workers, and by 1920, there were over 100,000. And just between the years 1935 and 1939, right during the Depression, there were 140,000 Mexican workers who came to California because of a supposed work shortage. And only to find that everyone else had the same story and there wasn't much work. Some more recent statistics, and I'm sorry again that these aren't as recent as I'd like, but in the 1970s, the average farm worker has 7 children, lives in a house probably not bigger than 2 rooms, which he rents for about $55 a week. Before a strike, a farm worker would probably earn about $1 an hour, and his family would work along with him. And he would buy food at the same store that the grower would buy his food. A farm worker would rarely achieve even the U.S. government's official estimates of the poverty level income. According to the United Farm Workers Union, the life expectancy of a farm worker is 49 years compared to 73 for the rest of the U.S. population. More than twice as many infants of farm workers die at birth than in the rest of the country. The chances that farm worker families will contract pneumonia, influenza, tuberculosis, or some other kind of infectious disease are 3 times greater than the national average. And a majority of the farm workers will probably never pass the 8th grade in education. In 1970, the Agriculture Department reported about 3 million farm workers, and a little over 2 million of these would be the migrant seasonal type of workers. And the average pay for them was $10 a day for men, $9 a day for women. And again, this is 1970 figures, not during the 30s. One thing that's interesting, if you've ever read any labor statistics on wages or whatever, you sometimes notice that there's an asterisk, and then you look at the bottom, it says farm labor is not included in the statistics, and this is because it brings down the statistics so much. And that, I think that's one example of how farm workers are not always seen as real human beings. There are other statistics, though, that aren't in the government labor figures, and one is some are just in the working conditions themselves, which vary greatly from where you are, but generally, in California anyway, go from bad to worse. Tremendous heat, few toilets, little or no water, little time for breaks during the day, back-breaking work, spending all day bent over, which can stunt your growth if you're growing up. Most often done with a short-handled hoe, which means you have to bend over farther. And I'm not sure exactly why they use a short-handled hoe all the time, but when you read about the farm worker movement, that's the epitome of the worst kind of work is working with that short-handled hoe. Absolutely no job security. You could be fired for just about anything, especially complaining. And you'd have lots of exposure to very dangerous pesticides if you're a farm worker. Marshall Fernandez, who was here a couple years ago, he worked with the United Farm Workers in California. He has some tapes in the library. He said simply, if you stayed, you lived in misery, but if you left, you didn't have anything to eat. So you begin to see kind of the bind that farm workers find themselves in. Really, no options to choose from. And I think any definition of poverty for me would include the lack of available options to get yourself out of a situation. But I think we could maybe look more closely at the life of a farm worker by looking at the life of Cesar Chavez. And some of you have the yellow sheets with his picture on. It's not a very good picture, but the only one I could find that I could Xerox. In the shadow of that immense description that I gave of the corporations and the big growers, Cesar is a fairly small man. He's 5'6", 5 foot 6 inches. It's interesting, I don't know if any of you saw the movie Excuse Me, America, shown last week with Domelder Camara, but there's a scene in there where Domelder Camara and Cesar Chavez are shown together, and Domelder Camara is much shorter than Cesar, so I don't know how tall he is, like 5'2". But Cesar, it's hard to get a picture of him because he's not often up in front of people. He seems to be a very shy man. He blends in with the workers. He always wears a work shirt, work pants, and scruffy boots. He's soft-spoken, gentle eyes, but he's a very powerful speaker at the same time. One writer said that he has a sense of quiet power about him, and I think that puts it very well. He's always had very little money, poorly educated from a large Mexican family. And one thing that anyone who knows Cesar knows about him is that he has a very, very bad back. And has spent much of his working hours in bed and has not been able to do lots of the work that he's wanted to because of his back. And I think that's because he was born with one leg shorter than the other. And the combination of trying to compensate for that and working in the fields as a child caused him to have a bad back. Cesar had a fairly typical experience as a farm worker, except for the fact that he was very lucky to come from a family that owned their own land when he was a child. Cesar's grandfather escaped injustice from a hacienda in Mexico and came over the border and finally moved to Arizona around Yuma and got some land and built a house, a fairly simple house, but one large enough to house three generations. It was there where Cesar's father started a grocery store business, and although they lived there for many years and got U.S. citizenship, they would still get letters and notes all the time saying, go back to Mexico where you belong, that kind of thing. Cesar was born in Arizona in 1927, which makes him, I think, 55. Today. He has two brothers and two sisters, but grew up with many relatives, cousins, and aunts and uncles. After a number of years of living on that land, they were forced to leave after they had some financial difficulties, and the farm was seized by the county in order to pay off some local taxes because a local banker wanted to get a hold of the land and would not give the family a loan. So Cesar still thinks of that home as a lost home, and even as the family had to move west to the fields to make money, they always wanted to move back, but of course never did. They found farm work in California much more difficult than they had expected. They'd heard all these stories about the lush green land and the available work, but of course everyone else had heard the same stories. And it was the middle of the Depression, and people were sort of flocking to that part of the country to get work, but there was very little available work, and people had to just keep on moving from town to town, from orchard to orchard, from farm to farm. Cesar never got past the seventh grade in education. Before that, they had moved so often that he had attended some 37 different elementary schools. But as a young male, he quickly became a valuable part of that family's ability to survive because he was able to work in the fields along with his father, picking lettuce and cotton and cutting grapes or whatever they were doing at the time. Like just about every other migrant farm worker family, Cesar's family never really made any money. They got just enough to live somewhere, to eat, and to buy enough gas to put in the car to move on to the next season of work. Many times they were living as far as 15, 20 miles away from where they had to work, so they'd have to either spend money for gas to get to work or bum rides off of people. For a while, they were living in worker camps, and those are on the grower's property, and the conditions are just horrible most of the time. Very little sanitation facilities, they're overcrowded, they're filthy, lots of crime. So they tried to stay out of the worker camps and find some little shack somewhere. Sometimes they were lucky enough, other times they weren't. Cesar recalls for a while living out of their car, and for one whole winter they lived in a tent. But somehow they made it, abused as they were. They somehow managed to survive. Cesar quickly began to see the whole thing as evil, but he has a particular disdain for what he calls the most evil of an evil system, which is the labor contractor. If you are a migrant farm worker and you want a job, you can't, in California at least, this is the way it was back, as late as the mid-70s and probably to some extent still today, you can't just take your resume and go to an employment office and fill out an application. Even if you were literate, you couldn't do this. What you have to do is go through a labor contractor who hires workers off the street and leases them to individual growers. And this is what the growers would do to make sure that they had enough workers coming in, but that they wouldn't have to deal directly with the workers themselves. And a labor contractor is actually the middleman who specializes in being a rip-off artist. He gets a fee from the grower and then whatever he can make on the side. And there were many ploys that the labor contractor would use. Lots of times they would just make the conditions sound ideal in order to get workers in the first place, but after a while they would just start to charge unreasonably high prices for food or for rent. Lots of times they would stall on payment. They would say, well, the crops haven't been very good, so I haven't gotten my money, I can't pay you right away. And this happened many times to the Chavez family, and they just said, Cesar writes, you were lucky at the end if you didn't owe the grower money after working there. And that's how terrible these labor contractors were. One favorite ploy of the labor contractors was to hire illegal aliens to do the work. This was, let's say, during a work shortage, or maybe after the domestic workers had, word had gotten around that this labor contractor was no good. The contractor would hire out illegal aliens, and then toward the end of the season they'd bring in the immigration officials who would find these guys out, send them down to Mexico without pay, and the labor contractor would be able to pocket all that money on the side. So it was just a very evil system. But as I said, Cesar's family soon learned to know the ropes and somehow survive. The work that they did was just plain hard, and Cesar, early on when he was a teenager, you could see his commitment to social justice and somehow his desire to change the situation that he was in. He writes, they should find a way of doing this work that will leave the human being whole. I think it can be done. Either the employers begin to see the workers as human beings, or the workers organize against the employers and demand changes. As I said, early on he was committed to this and to other areas of social justice. In 1943, when he was on a date with his girlfriend, Helen, who later became his wife, he was thrown out of a theater in Delano, California, for refusing to move from a white-only section of a segregated theater. He spent 2 years in the Navy, which he said were the worst 2 years of his life, and then finally got into organizing by accident. He met up with an organizer by the name of Fred Ross, who was trained by Saul Alinsky, and Cesar was so impressed by Fred Ross that he immediately volunteered to be part of his CSO, or community service organization, in the town Cesar was living in, which was called Sal Si Puedes, which in Spanish means get out if you can. And that can be taken a couple of different ways. One, just that the conditions were so bad that it was really hard for anyone to change their situation. Another part of it was that Sal Si Puedes was just one of these dirt towns with no sidewalks and no drainage really. It was just dirt with some shacks on it. And when it rained, as it does in California in the winter sometimes, the whole place just turned to mud. So if you had a car, you couldn't get your car out of the mud. So they called it get out if you can. But Cesar volunteered in a voter registration drive, being an organizer, going door to door, trying to organize people making $35 a week. And he quickly became very successful, but also frustrated with the CSO's refusal to try to found a union for farm workers. Cesar saw this as a real problem, is that farm workers needed something to get at the roots of their problem. Cesar also became very wary of the CSO's professionalism, its power, and its salary increases. Cesar refused a number of salary increases, and he also refused to dress up for meetings. He always wore his work shirt, work pants, and scruffy shoes. He writes, "To come in a new car to organize a community of poor people, well, that doesn't work. And if you have money but dress like they do, then it's phony. It's professional hunger." Eventually, Cesar became the director of the national CSO, but in 1962, he finally just quit, convinced that he had to go on and start his own farm workers union because the CSO refused to. Like many people that work for social justice, he got tired of doing Band-Aid kinds of things and wanted to get at the roots of the suffering. So he gave up the security of the weekly paycheck. By this time, he was married and had two kids and about $1,000 saved up in the bank. And when he was on the road organizing, he'd sometimes have to beg for food and for places to stay. And after a year, he was still the same way. He didn't have any money. But he also turned down a job in that second year. The Peace Corps offered him a $21,000 a year job to organize something in, be director of something in South America. And he turned that down because he was very committed still to starting farm workers' movement. He held no other job during this time except occasionally working in the fields to make enough money to move on and do some more organizing. He says, "You can't organize farm workers with a secure job. After all, if you're outraged at conditions, then you can't possibly be free or happy until you devote all of your time to changing them and doing nothing but that." Cesar found freedom in that. He disciplined himself. He did some reading about the past history of farm worker movements and some of the defeats of unions. He developed some very definite opinions on how to organize. There were some other attempts going on at the time. There was an organization called AWOC, Agricultural Workers Organizing Committee, that was doing organizing of farm workers at that time in California. And they had lots of money. They had like $2 million from the AFL-CIO to do organizing, but Cesar didn't want to be a part of them because he just felt that any kind of large or even medium-sized financial contributions could have strings attached. And he just felt that money really wasn't the important thing anyway. It was the connection with the people and getting to know what their problems were and building up a sense of trust. And I think that's a large part of Cesar's success as an organizer, is that people always felt they could trust him, that he was working for them and not for some organization or not for his own ego. And I think that that's shown out, that the AWOC organization had all this money but no support, and after a couple years, Cesar still had no money, but he had the support of the whole valley among the farm workers. But things did not go well for a very long time. During the 60s were very rough years. He had to spend a lot of time just going door to door and getting support from people. He was an excellent organizer, but there were some barriers because farm workers were generally considered unorganizable for a number of reasons, which I'll quickly outline. One is simply the poor image of the people had of themselves. And I think that's true for any social justice movement when it's beginning, is that the biggest barrier is the people themselves, not only their conditions, but their feeling of powerlessness, their inability to see anything better. Cesar notices when he went door to door that when he asked people what they could envision for themselves, and at that time people were really only making 90 cents an hour, and he said, "Well, what do you think you deserve, or what would you like to see?" And people could only envision $1.10 an hour. That was their dream. And so that he saw right away that a big barrier would be the people's opinion of themselves and what they deserve. Second problem I alluded to a little bit earlier was just the sheer size and power of the growers. And not so much that they had, that they were big and that they had money, but that there was this intricate web of collusion between the growers and the police and the courts and the financial power of the big corporations and the banks and the utilities to keep that system, that agricultural system, going as it had been going. The growers, as I said, had control over a lot of the legislation, and legislators had always decided in favor of the growers. For instance, agricultural workers are exempt from state and federal unemployment insurance benefits. Only a small number of farm workers had been covered by Social Security, no minimum wage at all. Workers were excluded from any kind of overtime provisions. Agribusiness was excluded from any kind of collective bargaining laws, which made it hard to establish a union because you couldn't get recognized. The assumption was is that no matter how much California agribusiness resembled an industry, it should not have to meet the social obligations that apply by law with any other industry. That the assumption was you just didn't have to take care of your workers. And that was the reason that farm work became very undesirable. It was just the kind of work that no one wanted, and it led to a worker shortage, and the growers thought that it was the government's responsibility to then go after and get workers in order to keep the system going. One way in which the system worked, the way the government guaranteed to the growers that they'd always have workers, was through the operation of the bracero system. And a bracero is another name for a worker brought in from Mexico to be a migrant worker for a while and then brought back to Mexico when the season is over. They're in on a special pass. And the problem was that too often braceros were brought in when there were domestic workers that were still out of work. And that was illegal, but it happened all too often. And it just served to provide the growers with this abundant, semi-captive, immigrant, alien force, labor force, and that was their best guarantee against any organizing, because aliens didn't want to be organized because they were going back to Mexico, or they really didn't know how much they were being abused and exploited. And so when domestic workers started to complain on the job, they'd be fired and the aliens were brought in, or if there was a strike, the Mexican braceros were the perfect scabs because they could be shipped back to Mexico at any time. That was one very devastating part of that system that the government supported. Another barrier to organizing was some misconceptions or some assumptions about farm workers and about growers. Again, as I said, opinions about growers were very good. A lot of times they appealed to the public as farmers that deserved all sorts of privileges. The growers, on the other hand, sort of looked at the farm workers as maybe a slave owner in the South would have looked at a slave during the 1860s. They were convinced of the homing pigeon myth. In other words, the farm workers must have loved the work, otherwise they wouldn't come back every season. But of course the growers had no idea of what kind of life the farm workers lived or where they went when their work wasn't needed. It was assumed on the public assumed that this kind of system that the growers had to exist in order for agriculture to continue the way it had in California. And that's why you had pretty soon citizens groups popping up all over California that would work against farm workers' movements and would publish little leaflets that would say things like, agriculture is the very foundation of our nation. Weaken our agriculture and our entire structure would give way and crumble. So any effort to organize farm workers was seen as a subversive threat to agriculture, and all these groups, citizens groups, were supported then by the growers. Another related problem was the media. In any kind of social movement where you're using boycotts and strikes, the media is so important. And Marshall Fernandez on his tape says that in his opinion, the media was 95% bad and 5% indifferent. And that might be a little strong, but from what I know, the media coverage was not good of the farm workers' movement. From the moment Cesar started organizing, and this was way back in the 40s, before the farm workers' movement started, he was labeled as a communist and has spent most of the rest of his life trying to convince people that he's not a communist. The Republicans and the Republican media red-baited him so bad that sometimes what he'd have to do to convince the farm workers that he wasn't a communist was go in to a church and get a priest to come out and give him a blessing, and that would convince the people that he was not a communist. But he is still trying to convince people. And I think part of the reason is that he was trained by Saul Alinsky, and I think people assume that he was a communist because his name sounded Russian or something. I don't know. But the media was a problem for a long time. And then just some logistical problems. Farm workers were unorganizable because of the transiency of the workers. You had this constant flow. And on your maps, if you have them, you can see Delano in the south and then the grapevine goes all the way up the state. There was this constant flow back and forth of workers moving from crop to crop so that they could be working all year. Incidentally, that's why grapes were chosen as the first fruit to pick to start boycotting and striking, because grapes need attention some 10 months of the year, whether it's picking or pruning or spraying. So the labor force is a little bit more stable with grapes than some other crop. But the transiency of the worker population was a real big barrier, because there was no union, there was no way to really document a lot of the violence that was done to the people there. Another problem was that migrants were usually housed in these labor camps that were owned by the growers, so you didn't have access in to organize people. You would be trespassing if you tried to organize the workers. And then again, there was the overabundance of that labor supply. There were always scabs to take over when you tried to strike. But anyway, to quickly outline the movement, it took off very slowly. The 60s were spent mostly trying to get the police and the courts off the back of the people. There was much, much violence done by the growers with the police on the picket line around Delano, California. Some pickets were sprayed with pesticides on the picket line. Some were run over by cars. Some had gunshots over their head. There were cases where, I think, four times arsonists tried to burn down the union headquarters. The co-op gas station was bombed twice. There were numerous threats on Cesar's life. At one time, there was a $25,000 contract for his life, and evidence that the government knew about it and tried to cover it up. Their office had to move several times because it was bugged so often. But things progressed. The union was called the NFWA, the National Farm Workers Association, at the beginning. And it was a very broadly based group. It wasn't just Mexicans. There were volunteers that were college kids, whites, blacks, church people, lay people, labor people, Protestant, Catholics, Jews, atheists, all sorts of people came. Farm workers' movement also became a women's movement in a way. Cesar always had women involved from the beginning, even though men were made up most of the farm worker labor force. Cesar knew that if women were involved, or if the whole family was involved, you'd get more commitment, because it was a family cause. The first person Cesar hired on his staff was a woman by the name of Dolores Huerta in 1965, and she later became the first vice president of the farm workers movement, and the chief spokesperson and the boycott strategist. And she was also responsible for getting women on the picket lines, which was very controversial because of all the violence that occurred on the picket lines. But also a strategic move, because it actually reduced the amount of violence, because growers just weren't willing to attack women, I guess. So it was a multi-ethnic kind of cross between a union and a movement. It was never just a union. It was called La Causa, which means the cause in Spanish. The goal was always equal rights for all, and self-determination and worker dignity. It was never just a money issue. Volunteers for the union, if you volunteered, you received $5 a week and expenses, and that is still true today, including Cesar Chavez. He does not make any more than that, just $5 a week. The union progressed very slowly through the 60s, and with a couple of small victories. Their first major victory was in 1965 against Schlenly Products, which was a table grape grower. And it was interesting how that worked out. During that time, Cesar had been following the civil rights movement in the South and knew what kind of emotional impact the Selma civil rights march had in the South. And so he decided to have his own march. I think in Spanish it's called peregrinación, a pilgrimage. And they had farm workers march from the town of Delano, where the union headquarters were, to Sacramento, where the capital was. It was about 230 miles, the same distance as Gandhi's salt march to the sea in the 1930s. Workers marched for 25 days, started out with just a few hundred and ended up with 10,000 workers on the steps of the Capitol on Easter Sunday. And it was the movement's first real exposure to any kind of local press or national press. And there were rallies and street theater, and it was a big victory. I think they got $1.75 an hour, raised from 90 cents an hour, and a new union-run hiring hall, which would replace that labor contractor system that was so evil. I won't go through all the details because we're short on time, but there are countless battles with not only the growers, but also with the Teamsters Union, which the farm workers had to fight. Teamsters Union would sign sweetheart contracts with the growers, and there were contracts broken and elections that were rigged. I won't go through all that, but I do want to point out a couple things about the movement that I think are the most important. And I guess the overarching characteristic of the farm worker movement that attracts me is its nonviolence. And that's a commitment that's not just a philosophy, but one that really worked. In fact, if you wanted to be a part of any picket line or boycott or strike, you had to pledge on paper to be nonviolent if you were part of Cesar's union. Even if you didn't agree with it as a philosophy, you had to agree to it at least as a tactic. And there are a couple of different ways that Cesar used that besides the march to Sacramento. The most successful and widely publicized, of course, which I'm sure most of you are aware of, is the boycott, the great boycott in the 60s, and then to a lesser extent, the Let Us boycott in the 70s. The UFW boycott was probably the most effective a sustained boycott has ever been in this country, besides the Montgomery bus boycott, and I don't think we'd really call that sustained. I think in Cesar's mind, the boycott ended up being more successful than the strikes, or at least the strikes would not have been possible without the boycott, because hungry people cannot go on striking. And there had to be another way to put pressure on the growers to get some change. But I don't think Cesar really had any idea what kind of effect it would have when he started in 1966. He got his boycott staff right off the picket lines. They were all under 25 years old. They had no money or very little. Sometimes they had to ride freight cars across the country. He sent them out to 13 major cities, and maybe they had one or two contacts of places to stay. But again, it was a group of very poor people that had nothing to lose, and they were very dedicated and ended up recruiting some 10,000 people to call and leaflet and boycott stores, and eventually it spread to 100 major cities. And at first the boycott was only a propaganda tactic because it didn't have an effect, but after a year or two the growers really started to feel that economic pressure, and the UFW had to go from boycotting certain brands of grapes to boycotting all California grapes, because what would happen, and I don't know if people are aware of this, if you did boycott grapes, is that the growers would trade labels. Growers would disguise their label. They'd make up a new label so it wouldn't look like it was Schlenly products or whoever else, Chiquita. But eventually the union started boycotting all California grapes, and then they had that union eagle that was on all of the boxes that you might remember, and that's on the map. Top of the map, the Union Eagle. After a while, by 1970, the boycott was so effective, along with public pressure that was caused by the boycott, that 95% of the fresh grape growers in California had to sign contracts with the United Farm Workers Union. And it was a tremendous victory for the union. But the boycott didn't always run smoothly. There were many attempts to stop it, to declare it illegal, to try to outlaw it during harvest time. But and for a while, Cesar went to jail for breaking a court injunction for boycotting because the courts tried to outlaw it. The farm workers, this was interesting, I didn't know this before, but the farm workers really knew that it was starting to be effective when the Pentagon started to fight the boycott. The Defense Department, before the boycott, was buying a half a pound of grapes per week per man for soldiers in Vietnam. A year later, during the boycott, they were buying 16 pounds per week per man. So it went up from a half a pound to 16 pounds after the boycott started. So in 1969, the Defense Department table grape purchase amounted to something like 10 million pounds of table grapes to sort of offset the economic pressure being put on at the Safeway stores. Ronald Reagan, who at that time was governor of California, announced that he was eating more grapes than ever. He attributed his good health and good looks to them and lost no opportunity to, in his travels, to denounce the boycott as illegal and immoral. Richard Nixon was also very anti-farm worker when he was elected in 1968. He was the only national politician to publicly eat grapes. He ate grapes on TV in Fresno, California. But nevertheless, it was very successful. And the lettuce boycott then grew out of that. And again, in some cities, grapes and lettuce were just literally shut down. It was that powerful. But again, I want to point out that the boycott was part of Cesar's larger, more deeply rooted commitment to nonviolence, and that commitment not only just in theory but in practice. And I think that's interesting because there's nothing in the history of either the farm worker movement or in either the cultures, either Mexican culture or Filipino culture, that suggests nonviolence. And in both cultures, violence is seen as necessary and inevitable and glorified. Nonviolence seemed to be the direct opposite of that Mexican machismo image, which equated manliness with aggression and violence. So it was definitely something that Cesar brought to the movement. And I think since the death of Martin Luther King Jr., he has been the America's leading practitioner of active nonviolence in this country. His commitment to nonviolence, I think, probably came... he's a very devout Christian. In some ways, he sees the movement as a religious movement as well as a social and political and economic movement. His commitment to nonviolence probably came first from his mother, who, although was not a spokesperson of nonviolence, I think she lived her life that way and taught Cesar I suppose you could call this early training. His mother never turned anyone away that came for food. And that happened quite often. She would tell Cesar and his brothers and sisters to go out and find hobos to come in and share their meals. She taught Cesar that violence was destructive, and that simply stayed with Cesar, and is something that he will not give up, even if nonviolence seems to be ineffective. So he's very concerned that the movement always stay nonviolent. And there was a time in the 60s when one striker was assaulted by a man driving a flatbed truck and permanently crippled, and there were many times under the eyes of police when the growers would beat and kick and shoot at the strikers. But whenever the idea of violence or reprisal came up, Cesar would say, "We can vote on anything except for discrimination and the use of violence. I just simply will not have violence." There was one time when a picketer was attacked by a black belt karate expert, and the picketer tried to defend himself with a lead pipe and broke the hand of the karate expert. And Cesar immediately kicked the picketer off the line, just said, "I will not have violence, even in self-defense." Cesar was also a follower of Gandhi, or still is a follower of Gandhi. He began reading Gandhi in his early career as an organizer and tried to model his movement in some ways like Gandhi, especially the boycott, which he says it's the most perfect instrument of nonviolent change because it uses the masses, involves the most amount of people to participate in the cause. Cesar also stayed in touch with Martin Luther King Jr. and with Dorothy Day. In fact, Dorothy Day flew to California a number of times and was arrested with him in 1973 on a picket line. You can get a good picture of the major influences of Cesar's life by looking. I'm going to read a short description of his bedroom where he spent much of his time because of his bad back. And I think it's kind of interesting. To the right behind his bed are a wooden crucifix and a photograph of a statue of St. Francis. On the right wall, a huge picture of Gandhi, a smaller portrait of Robert Kennedy, and a woodcut of a family burying their dead. Behind his bed, to the left, there is a black poster featuring three heads, those of President John F. Kennedy, Martin Luther King Jr., and Senator Robert Kennedy, and one word in red letters, why. There is also a small cloth hanging with the word love. From his study of nonviolence, Cesar learned that truth is vindicated not by infliction of suffering on your enemies, but on yourself. From a strong belief in Jesus Christ, Cesar saw the power of this kind of self-giving love and tried to implement that into his movement. He says, love is the most important ingredient in nonviolence. You could not remain nonviolent without it. We have not learned how to fully love the grower yet, but maybe love comes in stages. But hatred, there is no room for it. It does not allow us to do our work. It saps all our strength and keeps us from the work that we need to do. He also writes, the picket line is a beautiful thing because it does something to a human being. If you have a gun and they do too, then you can be frightened because it becomes a question of who gets shot first. But if you have no gun and they have one, well, then the guy with the gun has a lot harder decision to make than you have. One of the ways in which he showed this deep religious commitment to nonviolence, and this is something that I was not aware of, was he used the ritual of fasting. Several times during the grape strike and boycott, Cesar committed himself to penitential fasts. And one was shortly after a couple workers were killed on the picket line. The fast served as a call for sacrifice and for justice, and a reminder of how much suffering there had been among farm workers in the past. But the longest and the most publicized of the fast was in February of 1968, when Cesar fasted for 25 days. It was a Lenten fast during a time when there was increased hostility between the growers and the workers. And some of the workers had disobeyed the Pledge of Nonviolence, and there were some packing crates that were burned, and some scabs were roughed up, and some tires slashed. And Cesar began to see that it was increasingly difficult for the workers to remain nonviolent in the face of violence that was coming toward them. And so, seeing that this commitment to nonviolence was frayed a little bit, he decided to begin a publicized fast to rededicate himself and the movement to the principle of active nonviolent resistance, and to do penance for those occasions when he was led to feelings of hatred, and to do penance for the wavering of faith of some of his followers. And it was really effective in that way. It brought the movement together, it focused them on nonviolence and their ultimate goal, and quieted down some of the bickering that went on within the movement among the workers. His fasts were a real gamble, I think, because they were a direct challenge to that Mexican cultural image of machismo, and Cesar simply declared that this is wrong. And it really served to pull things together. And I'll read just a short paragraph of a speech that he wrote when he ended his fast. Robert Kennedy was notified of the ending of the fast and flew in and actually gave Cesar his first piece of bread. And Cesar was not able to read his speech because he was so weak, but someone else wrote it. And I'll read what he wrote. Someone else read it for him. Cesar wrote it. Our struggle is not easy. Those who oppose our cause are rich and powerful, and they have many allies in high places. We are poor. Our allies are few. But we have something the rich do not own. We have our own bodies and spirits, and the justice of our cause as our weapons. When we are really honest with ourselves, we must admit that our lives are all that really belong to us. So it is how we use our lives that determines what kind of men we are. It is my deepest belief that only by giving our lives do we find life. I am convinced that the truest act of courage, the strongest act of manliness, is to sacrifice ourselves for others in a totally nonviolent struggle for justice. To be a man is to suffer for others. God help us to be men. When it was over, they put me on a mattress in a station wagon. I had been up for about 2 hours, so the moment I hit the mattress, I went to sleep. Jim Drake told me that after the mass, people crowded around Kennedy, telling him he had to run for president. Kennedy was really moved. When he got in Jim's car to be driven to the airport, he turned to Jim and said, "You know, I might just do that." It was the first indication that he might run. I think that's interesting because I hadn't heard that before, but it was only, I think, 3 months later that Robert Kennedy was shot and or assassinated. And Cesar Chavez was one of 12 pallbearers at Kennedy's funeral. Just quickly, the other side to Cesar's commitment to nonviolence was that it was not only the right and the moral thing to do, but it was a sensible thing to do. It was the only thing powerless people could do. They had no chance to use violence, really, and be successful at it. Farm workers quickly discovered that nonviolence attracted support for the cause. There was a certain point at which the growers' violence and their manipulation of the police and the courts turned the tide against them. And the UFW won the support for the movement from people outside because they remained nonviolent, whereas damaging property would have only stiffened the resistance against the movement. So in another sense, it was a very rational, intelligent strategy as well as a religious commitment. To this day, United Farm Workers movement is still struggling along. I don't have a lot of information about what's happened in the last 3 or 4 years. All I've heard is what John Schramm heard on the radio a couple weeks ago, is that Cesar has now is going to step down from his leadership position and let some younger people take over. He doesn't want it to be, and has never wanted it to be, centered around him. So I think a couple other people are taking over more than he has in the past. But that is all I've heard. It's still struggling along, though. There are some bright spots. Since the beginning of Cesar's movement, farm workers have doubled their wages. They are covered by health benefits now. Child labor laws are rigidly observed, and workers have rights to discipline their own members. But there's still lots and lots of work to be done. Farm workers are not represented in many states, and there are no national laws covering them. I'll break now, and then we can, for people who want to go to supper and people who want to stay, can ask questions. One of the most important things that I learned about this was the hope that that Cesar has in the midst of all this. Someone asked him once, Cesar, how you are so small and the corporations and the growers are so big, how do you maintain a sense of hope? And Cesar responded, from knowing that the truth is with us. We have good work discipline and patience. These things go with nonviolence. When the people are with you, all you need is just time and patience. And I think that's one of the things that I learned from this living epistle of hope, is that to be hopeful is to be patient. And it has also convinced me that organizing is one of the hardest things that you could ever do. It takes so much time and patience that I don't have, but it also has convinced me of the power of poor people. And I think maybe that's one of the reasons that the movement was so successful, is that it was a group of people who had very little to lose. And one thing that I learned, I think for myself, that's been said by many other people, is that real leaders for social justice will not come from the middle class, from the educated, from the lawyers, from the legislators, but real leaders will come from within the group that is being oppressed. And I really think that's true. And it's there that we will find our hope for change, and it's there where people found Cesar Chavez, and that was their hope.